Live from the historic parsonage of 19th century gospel minister George Norcross in downtown Carlisle, Pennsylvania. It's Iron Sharpens Iron, a radio platform on which pastors, Christian scholars, and theologians address the burning issues facing the church and the world today. Proverbs 27, verse 17 tells us, "Iron sharpens iron, so one man sharpens another." Matthew Henry said that in this passage, quote, "We are cautioned to take heed whom we converse with, and directed to have in view in conversation to make one another wiser and better." It is our hope that this goal will be accomplished over the next hour, and we hope to hear from you, the listener, with your own questions. Now here's our host, Chris Arnson.
Good afternoon, Cumberland County, Pennsylvania, Lake City, Florida, and the rest of humanity living on the planet Earth who are listening via live streaming at ironsharpensironradio.com. This is Chris Arnson, your host of Iron Sharpens Iron Radio, wishing you all a happy Thursday on the 17th day of August, 2017. And today we are going to be speaking about something quite different than our normal topics on Iron Sharpens Iron Radio. Today we are talking about the Russians.
I'm afraid of the Russians. I can't sleep at night. So afraid of the Russians. Afraid we've got to fight. They've got ships at sea. They've got missiles in the air. Tanks on the border of Europe. And spies everywhere.
That's a blast from the past. I'm so afraid of the Russians. Well, should I be afraid of the Russians? We're going to talk about that today with retired Colonel David M. Glantz, who is a U.S. Army retired colonel, and he is also an American military historian, an author of nearly 40 books on the Red Army during World War II, and chief editor of the Journal of Slavic Military Studies. And it's my honor and privilege to welcome you for the very first time ever to Iron Sharpens Iron, Colonel David M. Glantz.
Well, thank you very much. It's really an honor to be invited to share my experiences with your crew. I've been blessed by a career that has allowed me to study the Soviet Union and today the Russian Federation. That experience goes back quite a few years to the time when I was a graduate student taking courses in Russian history. At the time, those courses being most interesting because of the vacuum in which Russian history seemed to exist. Few knew much about it, and I ate it up. I was an Army officer for a number of years when I decided to go into the foreign area program and decided the one thing I did need most was the Russian language. Ability to read more and communicate possibly with Russians if given the opportunity to do so. That was invaluable. I studied 3 years under Soviet emigre instructors, some of them old Marxists who had gone over to the other side. As an artilleryman in the Army, I then decided that perhaps the best place I could use my experience was in studying the Russians and preparing to deal with them better if the occasion arose in the future. And I did that in intelligence positions beginning in the 1970s. That combined with my penchant for research in military history resulted in essentially going in and establishing or helping to establish several shops, Army offices responsible for studying how the Russians conducted war, obviously at that point from the viewpoint of dealing with them should they begin war. There are certain ironies in all of this, and the ironies show that life, in fact, has its unexpected moments. And it was in 1988 when Gorbachev and Reagan effected their famous handshake that suddenly the mission, my mission, and the mission to my office changed abruptly to dealing with the Russians militarily to establishing some sort of basis to make the end of the Cold War a real reality.
And let's pick up on that in a bit. I just want to make sure I introduce, I should say. First of all, on the phone, we have one of my two co-hosts today, Dr. David C. Innes, who is chair of the program in politics, philosophy, and economics, and associate professor of politics at the King's College in New York City. Welcome back to Iron Sharpens Iron, Dr. David C. Innes.
Thank you, Chris. Pleasure to be here.
And then in the studio with me is my second co-host, the Reverend Buzz Taylor. It's great to have you back.
And today is going to be very interesting because I know nothing about what we're talking about.
Well, we'll make it a day just like any other day.
It does sound interesting, but I will be listening from the sidelines.
And Dr. Glantz, what I'd like you to do before we even get into the subject at hand and even your military career, I wanted to just have a summary, as I usually do with first-time guests on Iron Sharpens Iron. I want you to give a summary of your conversion testimony and how you became a believer in Christ through the providence and grace of God. What was the religion of your upbringing, if any, and what providential circumstances did our Lord use to actually bring you to himself and save you?
Well, it's a very interesting prospect and procedure how it passed, and it's really one of those unique cases where experience is the teacher. I was brought up in a Christian household, Methodist mother, Baptist father. I was brought up in the suburbs of New York at a time when religion was really in decline and decay, I would say. Sunday schools were chair-throwing ceremonies and so on. And basically, although I appreciated the goals of religion, I did not appreciate the means and the origins of how those goals were achieved. I was a Christian, mildly so. Throughout my Army career, we attended church on Christmas, and we attended church on Easter. And in reflection, if you look back at my entire military career, in particular after my retirement in 1992, you suddenly realize that you cannot plan what happens. What happens is planned for you. The number of times that my wife said we should pack for ADAC, that's a little site in the Aleutian Islands where you're sent if you do something incorrectly, were legion. And yet my career developed in a pattern whereby I got to do what I was most interested in doing, and I had success in doing it. And quite frankly, I felt myself blessed by the entire process. To make a long story short, there came a time in the late 1990s when I hit myself in the head and said, "You are dumb. You have been ignoring the things you should not have ignored. Someone has been watching over you, paving the way for you." There were some personal experiences associated with my mother's illness and her ultimately moving in with us that showed me that if you need help and ask for it, it is there. And ironically, I then became born again and joined the church in Carlisle. And I have not regretted it because it involved lifting tens of pounds, if not hundreds of pounds, off my back and putting my mind at ease.
Praise God. And it was just a providential occurrence that I even knew of my guest's background. I just knew him by sight as a quiet and polite gentleman who was an usher at Grace Baptist Church in Carlisle, where I'm a member, and I happened to be having a conversation with one of my elders, Mike Van Grau, and he said, "You know, you should interview David Glantz, you know, one of the ushers." And I said, "Yeah, why?" And he said, "Well, he's one of the foremost experts on Russia and the Soviet Union in the United States." And I said, "Really?" So I got.
Well, if I might interrupt, in a world full of experts, many of them self-proclaimed and many of them unjustified, there are very few experts on anything, and
right. Humility
is the name of the game.
Right, that's right. Well, I'm so glad that I found out about that and have you on the program today. And one of the things I wanted to find out initially is how you went from an enlisted man in the military to all of the sudden, of course it wasn't all of a sudden, but over a period of time, coming to the point where you were making regular trips to the Kremlin and were actually charged with that focus of responsibility involving the Soviet Union as a enlisted military man. How did that all come about?
Well, what you're doing is entering the realm of the inexplicable. It's that inexplicability that finally had the impact it did on me. I was commissioned a second lieutenant in the Army, graduating from college, Virginia Military Institute. I did what an officer was supposed to do. I went into a combat arms, in this case artillery. Why I went to VMI and why I did what I did, I can't tell you exactly why. I grew up amidst history books. My father was a lifetime history teacher. And I guess the Civil War history, which was one of my first passions, led me to that college and its unique ambiance associated with it. If you track my career, an artilleryman in Europe, an artilleryman in Vietnam, albeit in a bunker most of the year, planning artillery fires, going through the rudimentary schools, officers basic, officers advanced, and finally in Vietnam, one morning, temperature 120 degrees, the door to my hooch opened, and I was laying stark naked on a bed, a little cot, and in walked this dapper, nattily dressed colonel who said, "How would you like to teach at West Point?" I said to him, "Look around." And essentially, I made that leap from an artilleryman in a hooch in Vietnam to a teacher at West Point. I'm not a doctor, incidentally. I'm a colonel. I have a master's degree, and that was
Did I call you a doctor?
Yes, you did.
Oh, I'm sorry. I did that.
I have to be careful. That's not an insult now because one of my daughters is, and I constantly call her that, and she cringes.
I just meant to call you colonel. I don't know how doctor slipped out.
You can call everybody doctor, you know. It's one of those things.
But anyway. In any case, I came back from Vietnam. I was supposed to go to West Point and teach in about a year's time, and we were sitting around a table in my wife's parents' house in North Carolina on a Saturday night playing, I think, canasta, and the phone rang at 10 o'clock, and I picked the phone up, and it was West Point. "Can you come up and teach Monday morning?" And I said, "No, I'm on leave from Vietnam, but I'll do it in a week." And so there I was a week later in West Point teaching modern European history. I taught it for 4 years. I enjoyed the tour thoroughly, and I've never read more in my entire life than I read during those 4 years. Finishing up there, I went on to Fort Leavenworth, the Command and General Staff College, which is a routine assignment for someone who makes major. And there I made a decision. Having studied and loved Russian and studying and loving history, I decided perhaps I needed the Russian language. So I entered the Foreign Area Program, which gave me, in 3 years, the Russian language, although I would not recommend learning it at age 32 because your mind is not as supple for the receipt of a complicated language as it would have been if I was 15 or 16. In any case, I did pick up a good reading knowledge of Russian, a halting speaking knowledge of it. That led to an intelligence assignment in U.S. Army Europe, 7th Army, where I worked in the estimate shop, playing with things like estimates and doing assessments of the Soviet military. A very humbling job for a major who had several courses in Russian history and not much more. That led to an assignment at the Combat Studies Institute, a brand new organization at Fort Leavenworth, which for the first time would do research in history. Obviously, military history, and my expertise was in Russian. A call came through about a month after I reported there in 79. The call was from the Japanese, and the Japanese Internal Defense Force, Self-Defense Force, decided they wanted to do an exchange, a historical exchange between the two research organizations. I ended up doing the Russian portion of the program, and the topics the Japanese wanted me to address were Manchuria, Soviet Manchurian Offensive, August 45, followed by Soviet airborne operations and Soviet amphibious operations. If you understand the date, 1979, you'll understand the reason for that concern. That essentially brought me into the field of research. I produced two Leavenworth papers, mini studies, about 150 pages each on the Soviet offensive there. As a student in college, I'd read all the German authors, Guderian, Manstein, the generals who wrote in the 50s and 60s, and of course they portrayed a very inept Red Army, large, cumbersome, an army which really should not have been victorious in the war. And yet, doing the Manchurian study, I saw a very efficient military machine vanquish a very large, sizable Japanese force in a period of 2 weeks in essentially a theater of military operations, which Manchuria was. My question was, how on earth did they go from the inept body of troops that they had at the beginning of the war to something that was far more capable at war's end? That also dovetailed with what I had been asked to look at when I was in the estimate shop at USERA, and that is, how are the Soviets reconfiguring their forces in the event of war? All those things tied together. I then moved on to the War College after 4 years at CSI. The War College, I did the same thing, studied Soviet military operations with a desire to just glean out of those operations why and how they would operate today.
Is that the War College right here in town,
Carla?
That is
the War College, yes, right here in town. That's when I bought the house here. That three-year tour at the War College enabled me to look in depth at Soviet military operations in 1944 and 45, and I had already become convinced by reading Soviet periodicals, journals, military history materials that in fact, was the period in which they tested many of the things that they were considering in the 1970s and 1980s in the contemporary Soviet Army. All of this then culminated in the foundation of the Soviet Army Studies Office at Fort Leavenworth. Chief of Staff of the Army decided to create it to do open source analysis with a group of handpicked individuals, both civilians and military, that could look at the Soviet Army so we could better contend with it. That was 1986. 2 years later, we had the astounding process of Reagan shaking hands with Gorbachev, and immediately our mission changed. Our mission very abruptly changed into developing the basis for a possible U.S.-Soviet strategic partnership in the future, if common ground could be found. I and all of my office members spent the next 4 years, 1988 to 1993, actually 5 years, largely traveling to the Soviet Union, meeting with counterparts, exchanging materials. At one point, we brought our chaplain over and brought boxes of Bibles over to the Soviet Union. We came back with textbooks from the Frunze Academy, the Voroshilov General Staff Academy. It was a genuine discussion between folks on the other side who understood the Cold War was over and the conditions that had given rise to it had also changed fundamentally, and that some sort of new arrangements had to be reached. We saw what happened to the Soviet Union in 89 when the Warsaw Pact collapsed and they lost basically all of Eastern Europe. We saw in 1991, and this was not a U.S. victory, I might add. We say that, and that makes the Russians very angry. It was essentially a decline and failure of the Soviet state itself, which resulted in the birth of the Russian Federation. This Russian Federation, 1992-1993, continued that process of trying to found the basis for a partnership. It was a program advanced by Senior President Bush. It was a program that we were very active in, and it was a program I had very high hopes for. I retired from the Army in the last day of 1992, for the reason that I saw in the winds a change in that program. I saw, to be direct, that it was going to be canceled, and I said, if that's canceled, then I have no reason for staying around here. I was living on six-month extensions. I retired, and by doing so, I escaped into history, where I have been ever since, writing and researching on the subject I love.
Yes, and nearly 40 books later, here you are. And by the way, I want to let you know ahead of time that rather than answer a question that I might have that would force you to kill me later, just if I ask you anything that you don't want to answer, just tell me. But I know that David Innes over at the King's College in New York City has a couple of questions of his own, and since I can't see David, I want to give him the opportunity right now to pop in, and then later on, David, as you know, if you ever want to ask a question, just jump in when you find a moment to do so. You don't have to wait for me to ask you to ask your own question, but if you could, David, I know you have a couple of your own questions.
Yeah, well, since we're in the autobiography part of the interview, I thought I would ask Colonel Glantz, we just talked about your books. Do you have any advice for aspiring authors? That's a lot of books for anyone to write, and I assume you do other things aside from write books, eat, go to your wife, things like this.
I was going to say you perhaps ought to talk to my wife about that. It does preclude lengthy vacations. It does preclude doing things you would ordinarily do, I guess. I took up golf 2 years ago. I hadn't played a lick of golf in my life. But, yes, it is time-consuming, and you have to be, to a certain extent, driven by something, and the driving force for me was a passion to find out what really happened, to fill in those gaps. I might add that life has become a heck of a lot more difficult now because in the last 2 years the Russians have opened their archives substantially, and we're now receiving, I think my wife said they're trying to kill you with documents, and I think she's correct. What used to take a year is now taking two, and I'm running out of years, very frankly. So it takes a certain passion and love for the subject because you cannot do it unless you have a cushion to sit on. You cannot earn money, as you probably know, writing military history or history at all, for that matter. I have a cushion of military retirement. Without that, it would have been impossible.
I see. And any advice for anyone seeking a career in the military? You've had an extraordinary career in the military. Any advice for anyone today thinking of service or a career?
Well, I do have advice, and it's more and more difficult today, I think, for a variety of reasons I won't get into. But first, don't try to predict what's going to happen. If you have a general desire, go for it. Don't worry about doing this or that, punching this or that ticket. Set your sights on what you want to do. Do it as well as you can, and let the chips fall where they may. We do need researchers. As I said, the Russian archives have opened at just the time when there are a dearth of military historians in general and Soviet military or Russian military historians in particular. So I lament the fact that much of that material is going to go unused, unread, and simply it'll be out there. And that's a genuine tragedy. 30 years ago, I was at a conference in the Academy of Sciences in Moscow, October 1987, and I said to them at that week-long conference, it is better to tell your own history than have someone tell it for you. It has taken over 30 years for that to come to fruition, and we need to have more folks working in the field.
Well, I'd like to ask you to, I know this is difficult in summary form because you could spend a week or more talking about the history of Russian government, but I'd like you to just give a overall summary of what occurred when the Tsarist Russia of the past, of the 19th century, collapsed and the Soviet Union rose to power. Lenin, Stalin, and those figures that were intricately involved in that. And then, of course, the collapse of the Soviet Union and the rise of the Russian Federation. So give us a summary of that, and if you could, compare and contrast the government of the Soviet Union with what we find in the Russian Federation today.
Wow. I just finished 7 years' work on what was supposed to be a single-volume history of the Battle of Stalingrad, and it ended up a trilogy in five books. And you're asking me? Yes. No, I'll simplify. The Tsarist Russia was a nation in change in 1917, 1918. It was a nation in change, and as so often happens, events intervened that caused that change to take a strange direction, a direction you might not have thought it would take. The Russians had abolished serfdom back in the 1860s. They were industrializing and modernizing the state. In the last 20 years of the 19th century, they began having political reform in the early 10 years of the 20th century. But as so often is the case, war disrupted those reforms. The Russo-Japanese War, very costly, very embarrassing, 1004-1005, caused turmoil. That plus the industrialization, the peasants moving to the cities, created a large proletariat, a large working class. The working class in factories can be organized much more easily than the peasants in the fields. To make a long story short, they went through a political evolution seriously disrupted by war, which ultimately not only disrupted the system, but brought the system down. The Russian decision to enter World War I, an honorable decision, honoring their allies, France and England, brought them into a war that turned out disastrous for them, disastrous for the Russian people. And in the turmoil and costs, harsh consequences of that war, you had political movements arise. The Social Democrats, the Bolsheviks, ironically, the minority party who called themselves the Bolsheviks, because Bolsha means majority in Russian, the Mensheviks, the larger segment of the Social Democratic Party. Political infighting where organization and leadership and platforms mean something. Well, it was the Bolsheviks that came up with the organization and the platform and the slogans peace, land, and bread, and then put together the organizations through organizing committees in the factories and the army and, to a lesser extent, in the countryside, that essentially turned what was initially a democratic revolution, the revolution in February 1917, into what was a coup d'etat in October, November, depending on which calendar you use, 1917, where this small, well-organized band managed to seize control in the cities. And what you had in a fairly accelerated process was the consolidation of power by Lenin. A democratic revolution, supposedly, which, given the system, the dictatorship of the proletariat almost inevitably resulted in the most crude and the most skilled member of that upper elite, Stalin, to seize power in the mid-1920s, take total power in the early 1930s, conduct a bloodbath in collectivization and industrialization, and eventually political and military purges in the 1930s that made his power absolute. In reality, that is what revolutions do. They go through stages, and the stages inevitably become harsher and harsher. Sometimes you have a reaction, sometimes the resulting regime is so powerful that it seizes and holds control. Then they went through what is probably the most disastrous period of their entire history, the so-called Great Patriotic War, Velikaya Otechestvennaya Voyna, where the Germans invaded. Stalin, although he was aware it was possible, had not accommodated it well. The Russian army, the Soviet army, the Red Army, was not able to do well in the opening months of the war, and because of that lost some 5 million soldiers in the first 6 months, which is essentially losing your entire peacetime army. The war was a cauldron in which deprivation, desperation, extreme discipline all coalesced to produce ultimately a fighting machine by 1943 that was able to vanquish the Germans. The Germans simply bit off more than they could chew, and that became apparent. There were many Russians who hoped that war and the tremendous privation associated with it would produce something less autocratic after the war. They were disappointed. And Stalin emerged from the war with the same sorts of policies, and apparently in the early 50s was about ready to institute new purges. This idea, when Stalin died, or was helped along, we don't know for sure the truth of it, his successors were more akin to controlling power amongst themselves, a small group at the very top. Stalinism was never renewed and returned. But nevertheless, the system that was so highly organized and whose ideology precluded economic and social change led to the sorts of conditions, plus this penchant for never allowing World War II to happen again, for not forgetting what had transpired in 1941, led them into essentially a militarized state, which by the mid-1980s could not function as a normal state and could not sustain political change. The money ran out, very simply.
And we're going to pick up right where you left off when we return from our first commercial break. If anybody would like to join us on the air with a question of your own, our email address is chrisarnson@gmail.com, chrisarnson@gmail.com. Please give us your first name at least your city and state, and your country of residence if you live outside of the good old USA. Don't go away. We'll be right back with Colonel David M. Glantz and more on Russia.
One sure way all Iron Sharpens Iron radio listeners can help keep my show on the air is to support my advertisers. I know you all use batteries every day, so I'm urging you all from now on to exclusively use BatteryDepot.com for all your battery needs. At BatteryDepot.com, they're changing the status quo. They're flipping the script. They're sticking it to the man. In other words, they'd like to change the battery industry for good by providing an extensive inventory of top-of-the-line batteries that are uniformly new, dependable, and affordable. Ordering from BatteryDepot.com ensures you'll always get fresh out-of-the-box batteries you can count on to work properly at competitive prices. Whether you need batteries for cordless phones, cell phones, radios, PCs, laptops, tablets, baby monitors, hearing aids, smoke detectors, credit card readers, digital cameras, electronic cigarettes, GPSs, MP3 players, watches, or nearly anything else you own that needs batteries, go to BatteryDepot.com. Next day shipping available. All products protected by 30-day guarantees and 6-month warranties. Call 866-403-3768. That's 866-403-3768. Or go to BatteryDepot.com. That's BatteryDepot.com.
Charles Haddon Spurgeon once said,
"Give yourself unto reading. The man who never reads will never be read. He who never quotes will never be quoted. He who will not use the thoughts of other men's brains proves that he has no brains of his own. You need to read."
Solid Ground Christian Books is a publisher and book distributor who takes these words of the Prince of Preachers to heart. The mission of Solid Ground Christian Books is to bring back treasures of the past to minister to Christians in the present and future, and to publish new titles that address burning issues in the church and the world. Since its beginning in 2001, Solid Ground has been committed to publish God-centered, Christ-exalting books for all ages. We invite you to go treasure hunting at solid-ground-books.com. That's solid-ground-books.com and see what priceless literary gems from the past or present you can unearth from Solid Ground. Solid Ground Christian Books is honored to be a weekly sponsor of Iron Sharpens Iron Radio.
Hi, I'm Buzz Taylor, frequent co-host with Chris Arnson on Iron Sharpens Iron Radio. I would like to introduce you to my good friends Todd and Patty Jennings at CVBBS, which stands for Cumberland Valley Bible Book Service. Todd and Patty specialize in supplying Reformed and Puritan books and Bibles at discount prices that make them affordable to everyone. Since 1987, the family-owned and operated book service has sought to bring you the best available Christian books and Bibles at the best possible prices. Unlike other book sites, they make no effort to provide every book that is available because, frankly, much of what is being printed is not worth your time. That means you can get to the good stuff faster. It also means that you don't have to worry about being assaulted by the pornographic, heretical, and otherwise faith-insulting material promoted by the secular book vendors. Their website is cvbbs.com. Browse the pages at ease, shop at your leisure, and purchase with confidence as Todd and Patty work in service to you, the church, and to Christ. That's Cumberland Valley Bible Book Service at cvbbs.com. That's cvbbs.com. Let Todd and Patty know that you heard about them on Iron Sharpens Iron Radio.
Hi, I'm Pastor Bill Shishko, inviting you to tune in to A Visit to the Pastor's Study every Saturday from 12 noon to 1 p.m. Eastern Time on WLIE Radio, www.wlie540am.com. We bring biblically faithful pastoral ministry to you, and we invite you to visit the pastor's study by calling in with your questions. Our time will be lively, useful, and I assure you, never dull. Join us this Saturday at 12 noon Eastern Time for a visit to the pastor's study, because everyone needs a pastor.
Welcome back. This is Chris Sarnes, and if you just tuned us in, Our guest today for the full 2 hours with about 90 minutes to go is retired U.S. Army Colonel David M. Glantz. We are speaking about Russia and what threat it actually poses to the United States in the 21st century. And co-hosting with me are Dr. David C. Innes, Chair of the Program in Politics, Philosophy, and Economics, and Associate Professor of Politics at the King's College in New York City. And in the studio with me is the Reverend Buzz Taylor. If you'd like to join us on the air with a question of your own, our email address is chrisarnson@gmail.com, chrisarnson@gmail.com. And please remember to always give us at least your first name, your city and state, and your country of residence if you live outside of the USA. And I know that before the break, we reached a point where Stalin had died, and there was some question as to whether that was a natural death or not. And the collapse of economy in the Soviet Union. And so if you want to pick up right where we left off there.
Yeah, picking up where I left off at the last half hour, by the 1980s, it was clear the Soviet Union faced major problems. Anyone who says that they could predict that this would happen and that there'd be collapse in the near future, I think, is a scoundrel. I traveled extensively there in the 70s, some travel in the 1980s. I saw signs that made me concerned, but they were signs like grass growing between the cracks in sidewalks and monuments, broken glass in windows along the street, building product shops that had nothing but cans of Bulgarian grape beans, green beans, the Hotel Ukraina, one of the bigger hotels in town, where a 50-page menu had one item on the menu at any given time. There were signs of decrepitude, and we now know that those signs extended all the way through the political system. In effect, by 1987 and 1988, many leaders in the Soviet Union realized that something had to fundamentally change if the nation was going to continue. And certainly the Cold War, with its huge expenses and great potential threats, could not go on. This led to the famous handshake between Gorbachev and Reagan. The handshake was an admission that circumstances around the globe had changed. Our argument was, with our Russian counterparts, that there were new challenges, new global challenges, and that many of these challenges affected Russia and the United States equally. This would take time to gel. The discussions were extensive. They went on here and over there. Frankly, by 1992, I was fairly confident that this partnership program would indeed work, and there were certain elements of the partnership. The Cold War would end. Military blocs would either disappear, but certainly NATO would not be expanded extensively toward the east at the expense of the falling or the collapsing Soviet Union. The question of international crime, international narcotics, the question of what will China do in the future, what will Iran do in the future, and in the 90s, the question of Islamic fundamentalism rose its ugly head. And in fact, our office, Foreign Military Studies Office at Leavenworth, organized to address those problems. What prompted me to leave the Army was when I heard that those initiatives, the initiative of fostering partnership, the initiative of addressing Islamic terrorism, the initiative of countering international crime, was not an important one, and it would no longer be allowed for organizations such as ours to address them. My response was to call up Washington, have them pull my extension, and go home and tell my wife, we're through, I'm going to write history. It came to pass a year later that exactly what had been rumored took place. All of those functions were taken away from operating units around the military. There were many, many officers looking at those questions, and they were withdrawn back to the NSC, for better or for worse. I did escape into history. Russia escaped into 10 years of chaos. I call it the Wild Wild East, where political change under Yeltsin, attempted economic reforms too hastily adopted, led to not only a complete lessening of productivity, but also to the emergence ultimately of a kleptocracy of the old leaders simply picking up the industries and continuing them without reforming them. There were a whole series of things, but I guess what most characterized the 90s, my visits there, was when you walk along the Arbat and see veterans of the Great Patriotic War selling their orders of Suvorov and Kuznetsov and even Hero of the Soviet Union badges for whatever the traffic would bear from foreigners. This, more than anything else, indicated to me that the Russian Federation was now in serious problems. We know the Soviet Union itself fell in 1991. It essentially collapsed of its own weight, with many of the constituent republics becoming independent again. Yeltsin tried to establish a commonwealth of independent states, which in theory still remains as a loose confederation of former member states of the former Soviet Union. What happened, of course, war had its impact, the Chechen War in this case, the inability of the Russians to handle the problem of Islamism, of Islamic fanaticism, and spreading. Of course, to them it was a major threat because the entire central portion of the Russian Federation was Muslim up the Volga River as far as Kazan. They tried to stop it in Chechnya, were embarrassed in Chechnya when they lost the first Chechen War. This, more than anything else, prompted Russia to look for someone who could restore some sort of effective leadership, some sense of unity, and some sort of pride in what was left of what was once a very great nation. Enter stage right, stage left, Putin. Putin did fight the Second Chechen War. He did it under an incredible shroud of secrecy, fought it successfully, figured out a way to maintain relative peace there and stop the spread of separatism into Russia proper, into the Russian Federation proper. And he continued. At that point, he continued to seek accommodation. Now, there was a great deal of complexity in what happened in Eastern Europe in the 1990s, but to me, one of the most disturbing things was the decision of NATO, an alliance that was supposed to be, and what I and my colleagues claim was a defensive alliance, became an actual offensive alliance in the late 1990s and went into Serbia, fought the war with Serbia, resulting in the independence of Kosovo. There were valid reasons for that to go on, but I think people should have understood what the message would be to Russia when we handled it in such a way. In my opinion, a ham-handed sort of way, because this, to the average Russian, showed that given NATO expansion, given the willingness of to turn NATO into an offensive force, that it was very likely in the future, from their perspective, that they might be the target of such a process. Now, this didn't happen overnight, these feelings. They evolved over time. But to make a long story short, by 2009, the situation worsened. It got better under the Bush presidency because we seemed to be doing some of their work, some of their work in their security interests in Afghanistan. They cooperated and supported us there. And they even maintained a kind of a mute criticism of what we were doing in Iraq. But there were prospects for partnership being renewed during that period. That ended fairly abruptly by 2008 and 2009. I think the Georgian War, more than anything else, indicated the path that Russia was about to take. A path which essentially said that revolutions such as had occurred in many non-Soviet, non-Russian areas, Kyrgyzia, Ukraine, ultimately Georgia, the various color revolutions, were in fact nothing more than a rehearsal for something larger that would take place in the future in Moscow. And many Russians thought that that was emanating from the United States, pure and simple. Whether they're right or wrong is not up for debate here. But that was the rationale for Russia to do what she did in 2009 in Georgia, to intervene there. Relations worsened, and of course, more recently we've had the annexation of the Crimea, something that is understandable given the fact that Russia had a 99-year lease in perpetuity over Sevastopol, but obviously has not done the proper way in international diplomacy, and then, of course, the venture in Ukraine. In short, in my belief, by the end of the first decade of the 21st century, Putin was willing to take risks that he would not have otherwise taken earlier. And those risks he took because He thought he found the first because he despised what happened in the 1990s, and he also despised what was happening more recently. And second, because he perceived there was weakness on the part of the U.S. and they would not react. The ultimate question is that risk-taking over? Could that risk-taking continue, in particular if the Russians perceive a paralysis in this country, a political paralysis, and this concerns me over the present conflict of an attempt essentially to get rid of a president. If you end up with complete gridlock in this country and an inability to act, then you vastly increase the chances of Russia doing something that she ought not to do. Probably in the near abroad, and I'm talking specifically about Estonia, the Baltic states, and other parts of the former Russian Empire. Do I consider it likely? No. Do I consider it possible? Yes. But much of it depends on how well the United States settles its own current political disputes and how well it rids itself of the rancor that now characterizes our political scene.
Well, I'd like you to now give us some kind of a comparison between the communism of the Soviet Union and the political system that we are now seeing in the Russian Federation. How is the Russian Federation different? Also, of course, some added elements to that of the Soviet Union had been known, infamously known for great brutality with genocide even exceeding that under the or by the hands of Hitler and the Nazis. If you could give us basically what you would see as the most vivid contrast or comparison between the communism of the Soviet Union and what we have today under Putin in the Russian Federation.
Well, first and foremost, they're very different. Communism is dead. The battle was fought out. It was fought out largely in the last 2 years of the 1990s, the first several years of the first decade of the 21st century. Putin was definitely concerned about Zhuganov and the communists. They were the number two party in elections, even though they were declining in strength. That's not to say that there aren't many Russians who look back at Stalin, at least the elderly Russians who look back at Stalin and still wish his safety net were still there. They are there, but they're diminishing in number and are dying off. The system under communism was far more rigid, far more autocratic, far more total in its control of the population. I know people who are writing things today in Russia who would have been imprisoned, if not more, in the communist state. The military is totally different now. By no means is massive. People have to appreciate the fact that when the Soviet Union lost the Warsaw Pact, it lost what it called its first strategic echelon. That is, its first wave of strategic depth in the event of war. Those were the East European states. When they experienced the revolution of 1991, they lost all of their strategic depth. The entire second strategic echelon, the Baltic states, Belarus, Ukraine, the Transcaucasus region, and all of Central Asia. If you look at the Russian Federation as compared to its predecessor, its area is vastly reduced, its population is vastly reduced, and its capability for production is vastly reduced. It varies from area to area. Their military is a fraction of what it was then. Instead of fronts and army, potential wartime fronts and armies with hundreds of divisions, now you have somewhere in the neighborhood of 50 brigades, perhaps additional brigades for artillery. And it's an army that was primarily designed to handle affairs, crises internally or in what they call the near abroad. Small things like the Georgian War. Now, having said that, you also have to understand that NATO has largely gone away. The NATO of the 1960s, 70s, and 80s has gone away. It is not a massive alliance of standing forces in Europe. And if you say, well, we're down now to the Russians being able to mobilize 5 to 10 brigades and perhaps an airborne division, you have to also understand that we have difficulties mobilizing a brigade of anything, much less a division. The Russians are also looking at the changing political situation, and ostensibly for defensive reasons, they're beginning to upscale their ground force structure. They've had divisions, ceremonial ones in Moscow. These are now taking part in the formation of a First Guards tank army in the West, with a clear Western orientation. Whether these will remain divisions or become corps, whether the brigades will be coalesced into something larger is anyone's guess right now, because all of these things are being worked out in the general staff. But there is one important continuity, and this is a continuity that I noted and continue to note whenever given the opportunity to do so, between what transpired in the 70s and first half of the 80s and what's transpiring now. In the 70s and the 80s, the Russians, the Soviets, attempted to modernize their army to cope with nuclear war and high-intensity technological war, high-precision weapons. And they were planning and did implement fundamental changes in their force structure. We didn't realize it until years after they did it. The lore elements of that, in other words, brigading forces, task organizing them in combined arms battalions, that went through the transition through 2009 and has formed the basis of the new Russian army. The question is, will they now institute the upper echelons of that structure capable of conducting theater warfare?
And that's a good place for us to take our midway break. If anybody would like to join us on the air, our email address is chrisarnson@gmail.com, chrisarnson@gmail.com. Please, as always, give us your first name, your city and state, and your country of residence if you live outside of the USA. And please only remain anonymous if it's about a personal and private matter. We look forward to hearing from you. And I know that we already have a number of you patiently waiting to have your questions asked and answered, or at least I hope you're waiting patiently. But I know that you're waiting, and we'll get to as many of you as we can before the conclusion of the program. But don't go away. God willing, we will be right back after these messages from our sponsors.
Hi, I'm Chris Arnson, host of Iron Sharpens Iron Radio, here to tell you about an exciting offer from World Magazine, my trusted source for news from a Christian perspective. Try World at no charge for 90 days and get a free copy of R.C. Sproul's book, Relationship Between Church and State. I rely on World because I trust the reporting. I gain insight from the analysis, and World provides clarity to the news stories that really matter. I believe you'll also find World to be an invaluable resource to better understand critical topics with a depth that's simply not found in other media outlets. Armed with this coverage, World can help you to be a voice of wisdom in your family and your community. This trial includes bi-weekly issues of World Magazine, on-scene reporting from World Radio, and the fully shareable content of World Digital. Simply visit wmg.org/ironsharpens to get your World trial and Dr. Sproul's book all free. No obligation with no credit card required. Visit World News Group at wmg.org/Iron Sharpens today.
Hi, I'm Pastor Bill Shishko, inviting you to tune in to A Visit to the Pastor's Study every Saturday from 12 noon to 1 p.m. Eastern Time on WLIE Radio, www.wlie540am.com. We bring biblically faithful pastoral ministry to you, and we invite you to visit the pastor's study by calling in with your questions. Our time will be lively, useful, and I assure you, never dull. Join us this Saturday at 12 noon Eastern Time for a visit to the pastor's study, because everyone needs a pastor.
Tired of box store Christianity, of doing church in a warehouse with all the trappings of a rock concert? Do you long for a more traditional and reverent style of worship? And how about the preaching? Perhaps you've begun to think that in-depth biblical exposition has vanished from Long Island. Well, there's good news. Wading River Baptist Church exists to provide believers with a meaningful and reverent worship experience, featuring the systematic exposition of God's Word. And this loving congregation looks forward to meeting you. Call them at 631-929-3512 for service times. 631-929-3512. Or check out their website, at wrbc.us. That's wrbc.us.
I'm James White of Alpha and Omega Ministries. The New American Standard Bible is perfect for daily reading or in-depth study. Used by pastors, scholars, and everyday readers, the NASB is widely embraced and trusted as a literal and readable Bible translation. The NASB offers clarity and readability while maintaining high accuracy to the original languages, which the NASB is known for. The NASB is available in many editions like a topical reference Bible. Researched and prepared by biblical scholars devoted to accuracy, the new topical reference Bible includes contemporary topics relevant to today's issues. From compact to giant print Bibles, find an NASB that fits your needs very affordably at nasbible.com. Whichever edition you choose, trust, discover, and enjoy the NASB for yourself today. Go to nasbible.com. That's nasbible.com.
Thrivent Financial is not your typical financial services provider. As a membership organization, we help Christians be wise with money and live generously every day. And for the fourth year in a row, we were named one of the world's most ethical companies by the Ethisphere Institute, a leading international think tank dedicated to the creation, advancement, and sharing of best practices in business ethics. Contact me, Mike Gallagher, financial consultant, at 717-254-6433. Again, 717-254-6433 to learn more about the Thrivent Difference.
We know we were made for so much more than ordinary life.
Blending faith, finances, and generosity. That's the Thrivent story.
We were made to thrive.
Have you been blessed by Iron Sharpens Iron Radio? We remain on the air because of our faithful sponsors and because of listeners like you. There are four ways you can help. First, do you know potential sponsors who may wish to advertise their goods or services on Iron Sharpens Iron Radio? Second, whenever possible, purchase the products or use the services that our sponsors advertise. And then let them know that you heard about them on Iron Sharpens Iron Radio. Thirdly, you can also donate to Iron Sharpens Iron Radio by going to our website at ironsharpensironradio.com and click support at the top of the page. But most importantly, keep Iron Sharpens Iron Radio in your prayers. We hope that Iron Sharpens Iron Radio blesses you for many years to come.
Iron Sharpens Iron welcomes Solid Rock Remodeling to our family of sponsors. Serving South Central Pennsylvania, Solid Rock Remodeling is focused on discovering, understanding, and exceeding your expectations. They deliver personalized project solutions with exceptional results. Solid Rock Remodeling offers a full range of home renovations, including kitchen and bath remodeling, decks, porches, windows and doors, roof and siding, and more. For a clear, detailed, professional estimate, call this trustworthy team of problem solvers who provide superior results that stand the test of time. Call Solid Rock Remodeling at 717-697-1981, 717-697-1981, or visit solidrockremodeling.com. That's solidrockremodeling.com. Solid Rock Remodeling, bringing new life to your home.
Every day at thousands of community centers, high schools, middle schools, juvenile institutions, coffee shops, and local hangouts, Long Island Youth for Christ, staff and volunteers meet with young people who need Jesus. We are rural and urban, and we are always about the message of Jesus. Our mission is to have a noticeable spiritual impact on Long Island, New York by engaging young people in the lifelong journey of following Christ. Long Island Youth for Christ has been a stalwart bedrock ministry since 1959. We have a world-class staff and a proven track record of bringing consistent love and encouragement to youths in need all over the country and around the world. Help honor our history by becoming a part of our future. Volunteer, donate, pray, or all of the above. For details, call Long Island Youth for Christ at 631-385-8333. That's 631-385-8333. Or visit liyfc.org. That's liyfc.org.
Paul wrote to the church at Galatia, "For am I now seeking the approval of man or of God? Or am I trying to please man? If I were still trying to please man, I would not be a servant of Christ." Hi, I'm Mark Lukens, pastor of Providence Baptist Church. We are a Reformed Baptist church, and we hold to the London Baptist Confession of Faith of 1689. We are in Norfolk, Massachusetts. We strive to reflect Paul's mindset to be much more concerned with how God views what we say and what we do than how men view these things. That's not the best recipe for popularity, but since that wasn't the apostles' priority, it must not be ours either. We believe, by God's grace, that we are called to demonstrate love and compassion to our fellow man, and to be vessels of Christ's mercy to a lost and hurting community around us, and to build up the body of Christ in truth and love. If you live near Norfolk, Massachusetts, or plan to visit our area, please come and join us for worship and fellowship. You can call us at 508-528-5750. That's 508-528-5750. Or go to our website to email us, listen to past sermons, worship songs, or watch our TV program entitled Resting in Grace. You can find us at providencebaptistchurchma.org. That's providencebaptistchurchma.org. Or even on sermonaudio.com. Providence Baptist Church is delighted to sponsor Iron Sharpens Iron Radio.
Hi, I'm Pastor Bill Shishko, inviting you to tune in to A Visit to the Pastor's Study every Saturday from 12 noon to 1 p.m. Eastern Time on WLIE Radio, www.wlie540am.com. We bring biblically faithful pastoral ministry to you, and we invite you to visit the pastor's study by calling in with your questions. Our time will be lively, useful, and I assure you, never dull. Join us this Saturday at 12 noon Eastern Time for A Visit to the Pastor's Study, because everyone needs a pastor.
I'm afraid of the Russians. I can't sleep at night. So afraid of the Russians. We've got to fight. They've got ships at sea. They've got missiles in the air. Tanks on the border of Europe. And spies everywhere.
Welcome back. This is Chris Arnes, and if you just tuned us in, our guest today for the full 2 hours with a little less than an hour to go is retired U.S. Army Colonel David M. Glantz, who is an American military historian, the author of nearly 40 books on the Red Army during World War II, and chief editor of the Journal of Slavic Military Studies. We are addressing Russia and what threat, if any, it poses to the United States in the 21st century. If you'd like to join us on the air with a question of your own, our email address is chrisarnzen@gmail.com, chrisarnzen@gmail.com. And before we return to the discussion, I just have a few announcements to make from our sponsors in regard to special events they're having. The Word of Truth Church in Farmingville, Long Island, New York, in cooperation with the Long Island Spurgeon Fellowship, is celebrating the Gospel of the Reformation, a 500th anniversary. The featured guest speaker or keynote speaker at this conference is Dr. Tony Costa, a dear friend of mine who is the professor of apologetics and Islam at Toronto Baptist Seminary. And joining him will be Pastor Caleb Bunch, Pastor Bruce Bennett, and Pastor Dave Corson, Friday, September 29th, and Saturday, September 30th, at the Word of Truth Church in Farmingville, Long Island, New York. And for more details on this conference, which is absolutely free, by the way, a love offering will be taken, but there is no admission fee. If you'd like more information, go to wotchurch.com, wotchurch.com, W-O-T stands for Word of Truth, wotchurch.com, or you can call 631-806-0614, 631-806-0614. The very next day, Sunday, October 1st, Hope Reformed Baptist Church of Medford, Long Island, New York, will be having Dr. Tony Costa, who I just mentioned, from Toronto Baptist Seminary. They'll be having him preach at their Sunday morning service at 11. If you would like to attend that service and want more information about directions and other details about Hope Reformed Baptist Church of Medford, Long Island, New York, go to hopereformedli.net. hopereformedli.net, or you can call them at 631-696-5711, 631-696-5711. Then coming up in November from the 17th through the 18th, the Alliance of Confessing Evangelicals is having their Quakertown Conference on Reformed Theology at the Grace Bible Fellowship Church in Quakertown, Pennsylvania. The theme will be For Still Our Ancient Foe, a reference to Satan from the Great Reformation hymn by Martin Luther, A Mighty Fortress. And speakers include Kent Hughes, Peter Jones, Tom Nettles, Dennis Cahill, and Scott Oliphant. If you'd like to join me at that conference from November 17th through the 18th in Quakertown, Pennsylvania, please call, or should I say, please go to the website of the Alliance of Confessing Evangelicals at alliancenet.org, alliancenet.org. Click on events and then click on Quakertown Conference on Reformed Theology. I plan to be there with an Iron Sharpens Iron radio exhibitors booth. Another place where I am intending to have an Iron Sharpens Iron exhibitors booth is Atlanta, Georgia, at the G3 Conference, January 17th through the 20th in Atlanta, Georgia, on the theme Knowing God, a Biblical Understanding of Discipleship. January 17th is exclusively a Spanish-speaking edition of the conference, and January 18th through the 20th is exclusively an English-speaking edition of the conference, featuring Stephen Lawson, Vody Balcom, Phil Johnson, Keith Getty, H.B. Charles Jr., Tim Challies, Josh Bice, James White, Tom Askell, Anthony Matheny, Michael Kruger, David Miller, Paul Tripp, Todd Friel, Derek Thomas, and Martha Peace. If you would like to register for the G3 conference, go to g3conference.com, g3conference.com. If you contact any of these organizations asking about these conferences or any other information, please let them know, please let these organizations know that you heard about their events from Chris Arnzen on Iron Sharpens Iron Radio. And now it comes time for that uncomfortable, most uncomfortable part of my show, is where I have to ask you for money. The advertisers that are currently keeping Iron Sharpens Iron Radio afloat have urged me to make these public appeals so that you will be aware of the urgent need that we have for financing to keep this program on the air. They want to further ensure a long future for Iron Sharpens Iron Radio, so that they have pleaded with me to make these daily appeals for donations and new advertisers. If you would like to keep this program on the air, if you are blessed financially above and beyond your ability to give as you have always been giving to your local church, and also if you are able to provide for your home and do not bring your, and would not bring your family into discomfort by providing for Iron Sharpens Iron, well, I would love to receive donations of any amount that you can afford by going to ironsharpensironradio.com. Click on support, and you will be given an address where you can mail a check for any amount made out to Iron Sharpens Iron Radio. And keep in mind, I never want you siphoning money out of the local giving to your church. That is a command of God, as is providing for your family. Supporting Iron Sharpens Iron Radio is not a command of God. But if you love this program, if it benefits your life, if you look forward to hearing it every day, and you're able financially to help us remain on the air, we would love to hear from you at ironsharpensironradio.com and click on support. If you'd like to advertise with us, just send me an email to chrisarnzen@gmail.com, chrisarnzen@gmail.com, and please give us the details on whatever it is you want to advertise, and as long as what you're advertising is compatible with the theology on Iron Sharpens Iron Radio, we would love to work out an ad campaign with you. Well, now we are back to our discussion with retired U.S. Army Colonel David M. Glantz who is also the chief editor of the Journal of Slavic Military Studies. We're talking about Russia and the threat that it does or does not have posed against the United States. And if you'd like to join us on the air, our email address is chrisarnson@gmail.com. chrisarnson@gmail.com. Before I take a question from David Innes, who is on line with us, he is he's on the faculty over there at the King's College in New York City, and he's our co-host, one of our co-hosts today. Before I go to his question, I was wondering, David, have you heard of Karen DeWish's book, Putin's Kleptocracy? I was talking to David. I'm sorry, David Glantz.
I've heard of the book, but I have not read. I haven't read anything in English in about 3 years.
Well, I just, the reason why I bring it up, I wanted to read the description of the book, and I wanted you to give your reaction to the description of Putin given. Is it Putin or Putin, or does it matter?
Putin.
Putin. Okay. I've heard both. So the description of Karen DeWish's book is, the raging question in the world today is, who is the real Vladimir Putin and what are his intentions? Karen DeWish's brilliant Putin's Kleptocracy provides an answer describing how Putin got to power, his cabal, the cabal he brought with him, the billions they have looted, and his plan to restore the greater Russia. Russian scholar Darwisha describes and exposes the origins of Putin's kleptocratic regime. She presents extensive new evidence about the Putin's circle, about Putin's circle's use of public positions for personal gain, even before Putin became president in 2000. She documents the establishment of Barak Rossiya, now sanctioned by the U.S., the rise of the Chero Cooperative, founded by Putin and others, who are now subject to visa bans and asset freezes. The links between Putin and Putin's palace near Sochi and the role of security officials from Putin's KGB days in Leningrad, many of whom have maintained their contacts with Russian organized crime. Well, basically, I want you to respond to that description, and if wanted to know how much of you, how much of that you concur with.
Kleptocracy is a characteristic, has been a characteristic of Russian society, be it Soviet or be it modern Russian. Kleptocracy, in the sense of what they used to call a nomenklatura. The nomenklatura were the high echelons of the Communist Party in the Soviet Union, and if you've been to a dacha, as I have been several times in the 80s, of any of these people, you'll understand they live a life that's quite different from the average Russian, to include Western toilet products, toilet tissue, so on and so forth. Now, if you are to build a case that Putin's is in, his entire existence is surrounded by the kleptocracy and that he is essentially drawing upon his old associates and building himself into a new czar, you can do that, but I think you're overstating the case. He is certainly not communist. He is certainly rooted in the imperial tradition. He wants a Russia as it was prior to 1917, and I'll give you a vignette on that one. I began publishing books on the Soviet Army in 1989, and my first sobriquet, the first title that they gave to, the first label they gave to me was bourgeois objectivist, as opposed to a bourgeois falsifier. By 1995, when I came out with my first expose of a forgotten battle, Operation Mars, they suddenly dropped the word bourgeois, obviously, but called me a falsifier. That label stuck with me, and I was lambasted in the Russian press through about 2000. In about 2001, all of a sudden, this is after Putin took power, a letter came to the University Press of Kansas, my prime publisher, that said, may we publish the Russian rights, maybe publish Glantz's books in Russian. They came to me. I said, give it to them. Since that point, they have published everything up to the last one. And I'm saying now that who knows whether this will continue or not. And I finally found out from another Russian why a good theory as to why that occurred. He was using my books to club his political opposition, Zhuganov, the communist mismanagement of the war, and showing in a new system they must have honest management instead of the old management. I would treat that title as sensational without saying all elements of it are wrong. Obviously, in Russia, like every other state, you have cliques. You rely on your circle of people. In Russia, traditionally, since it wasn't economically reformed properly in the 90s, it was the wild, wild east instead, you have had kleptocracy, certainly. But I would maintain that virtually every state, the more autocratic it is, the higher the degree of the tendency to kleptocracy.
By the way, I mispronounced a phrase here due to my blindness. It's a bank, Rossiya, not barrack. And I probably mispronounced a couple of other things because of my eyesight. But anyway, as far as the organized crime connection and as far as the brutality of Putin, I understand that he, at least from reports I hear regularly on the television, but as we all know, fake news is rampant on both sides of the aisle. What would you say about this man? Is this man a dangerous individual? Is he a psychopath? Is he a lunatic? Is he a megalomaniac?
I'm not a psychologist. I'm not a psychiatrist, so I can't know. He's not a Hitler.
Okay.
He's not a Kim, if you consider Kim to be over the edge. I don't entirely think he is. Russian society vis-a-vis American and Western societies has always been considered brutal because it is. It's coarse. It's much coarser. It's a different society, a different level of development, a completely different historical evolution. Rather than shooting hundreds or exiling thousands into deportation camps and essentially killing them at labor, Putin has an occasional journalist shot or stabbed or whatever you... This is Russian. The further south you go into the Caucasus, the more brutal some of the little satrapies he set up down there are. Now, this is not a surprise to anyone who studied Russian history. By the same token, you'll find the same thing in many Asian countries. You'll find and I'm not going to get into this business of which culture is more violent than others, but you'll find violence in many, many cultures, and it's generally characteristic, and it has its historical roots.
Well, I think that the... elephant in the room here is really going to be in the minds of many in regard to our most recent election. Do you think that Putin had anything to gain by rigging an election in favor of Donald Trump? I sometimes wonder why that would be, since it seems to me that if anybody is closer to a totalitarian system of government, it would be Hillary Clinton. But I don't know why he would have benefited by a Trump election. But I know that some of this, obviously, is your speculation. And some of, obviously, a lot of what you're saying is based on fact. But you're going to be hearing questions from me that are obviously going to involve your speculation.
Thank you. You have me off the hook.
Educated speculation.
I do have strong feelings about it. I have strong feelings about what's happened to the partnership program. I've looked very carefully as to what happened to it after I retired in 1992, and I have spoken out on it, and I don't care if people hear me speak out on it. I will give you the truth as I see it. There are many reasons why Putin detests Hillary Clinton, detested her. The reasons go back into the 1990s when the Clinton administration did those things that we had promised his predecessors we would not do. And that includes the actions in the Balkans. That includes a whole range of things. In a sense, what you saw in this recent election was, yes, Russian meddling. But meddling in elections is not a unique thing. Meddling in elections occurred. We meddle in elections. I won't get into specifics, but we meddle in elections too. It's in your best interest to do so. Do you rig it? No, because you can't. But what you can do is discredit someone you detest. And there's no doubt in my mind but that Putin detested Hillary Clinton. He detested her for a lot of reasons. And the meddling in this case took part in the release of the information that showed what she did to the Sanders folks, which was nothing less than fixing an election. Now, if that had an impact on some of the Democratic voters who realized that their candidate was being torpedoed by the Democratic Party, so be it. I cheered when that came out. I said, okay, it's about time somebody let people know what was actually going on behind the scenes. But that doesn't mean that he rigged anything. Now, having said that, I'm not sure if he's happy with the results. No one can say that until I see what the results are. That's all speculation. Hillary is not president. Trump is. Many people don't like him. What I am disturbed by is by this tendency. It's not a tendency. This penchant for essentially attacking the Russians as the sole cause of Hillary's loss, which carries the point to, we'll risk a nuclear war if it overturns this election. I think the Russian scare and the Russian baiting that has gone on is the most damaging thing to U.S. security in the next 5 to 10 years, because it may be the thing that causes Russia to do something we don't want them to do. It may, on the one hand, by creating paralysis here, tend to make them take risks they shouldn't. We may see that in September when Operation Zapad occurs, whether or not that has led them to do it. Whether it has another impact on them and to do something somewhere else in the world, I don't know. But that is not helpful to shrillness to the point of trying to overturn a government, or at least paralyze it in the interim, is not going to help the national interest of the United States.
Well, David Ennis at the King's College in New York City, what are your questions that you have?
Well, when we consider the danger or not that Russia poses to our country, I would like to ask you about, one, the military danger, and then also the interests that actually separate us. I think of the what I've heard about the invasion of Georgia, which I'm told was, everything was breaking down. It was this embarrassing intrusion. And then in Ukraine, one would think they would have achieved their objectives much more quickly, which I assume is like absorbing half the country. They seem to be having a very difficult time. What chances are they could do anything significant in the Balkans? And then just maybe you could comment on exactly what our clashing interests are in the world with this Russian rival.
Okay, let me start at the beginning, from the place where I depart. When we discussed with the Russians in the period from 88 to 92, 93, about common interests, the common interests were, as I labeled, the challenges, I won't use the word threat because it's a pejorative these days, but the challenges to both countries from China, the challenges to both countries from Iran, the challenges to both countries by Islamic terrorism, which was already underway in the early 1990s, although that has been kind of swept under the rug, and the international crime and international narcotics, which have affected both countries tremendously and affects the Russian Federation as much as it does ourselves. Those were the common interests. What's been disturbing is long about 2001 to 2003, if you read Russian publications, these interests had been generally underscored as unifying factors. Beginning in that period, you begin seeing minority reports, articles about, you know, maybe we ought to make an agreement with Iran. Maybe we ought to come to some settlement with Iran or China because there are so many Muslims in the Russian Federation. Why irritate them? In other words, those basic platforms for agreement began breaking down. I like to use the analogy of Stalin making his pact with Hitler in 1939 because of the incorrect threat he perceived from the West. He's made accommodations, in my view, he's made pacts with the devil he should not have made. Now, can that be redeemed? Yes, I think there were attempts to redeem it between 2001 and 2008, but those attempts to redeem it were essentially undercut by the great war controversy in this country, which prevented any sort of rapprochement from taking place. As far as Russian military capabilities, the Russians are more capable than they were in 1990 or 1995 or 2000. But are they anywhere near as capable as they were in 1985 and 1975? No, not by any means at all. I think they made a mistake they operated correctly in Georgia, and I think that was taking advantage of an opportunity provided when the Georgians went into southern Ossetia. And just from a person who studied this in great detail, it is utterly inconceivable to me that the Russians would allow the southern terminuses of two of the major Caucasus Mountain highways, military highways, built back in the 1870s, to fall into somebody else's hands. That's nonsense. Those are strategic pieces of terrain, southern Ossetia and Abkhazia. Nobody seems to understand that because nobody studied it. The action in Crimea was understandable, logical, and to a certain extent, in Russian eyes, totally justifiable. And it worked. What they did in Ukraine, in my view, was a mistake. They overreacted. They had proxies go in there, many of them out of the North Caucasus region, to do their fighting for them, and they discovered that they could not control their proxies. I think they would just as soon have gotten out of that area and not done it. My argument with them is you do not want to create a Palestine in Eastern Europe, like the situation we have in the Middle East. I think some Russians are appreciating that, although I've got no confirmation of it. Capabilities in Europe, for example, Chatham House just issued a report saying the biggest danger now is what will happen with Operation Zapad, the Operation Western, the exercise. Will they invade somebody like Lithuania or Estonia? And, of course, they don't make a value judgment on it. They say it could go either way. But when we look at it and say they're too weak to do anything of substantial, you ought to understand what's there to oppose them, and that doesn't exist anymore either. If you can field a brigade, if NATO can field a brigade in Europe, they can be lucky. They certainly can't field a division in Europe in less than 90 days. So you've got to put all that in perspective. I don't think they will act. I hope they do not act in September. But I don't think it's in their interest to act.
All right, we're going to go to our final break. Do you have any response, David, before we go to our break? David Innes?
Oh, no, that's very helpful.
Okay, and we're going to our final break, and we'll finally get to our listener questions. I'm sorry I kept you waiting so long. And if anybody wants to get in line in the event that we do have time to take any more questions, jump online at chrisarnson@gmail.com. chrisarnson@gmail.com, and please give us your first name, your city and state, and your country of residence if you live outside of the USA. And don't go away, God willing. We're going to be right back with retired U.S. Army Colonel David Glantz and more on Russia and its threat posed to the United States, if any at all. Don't go away.
Lynbrook Baptist Church on 225 Earl Avenue in Lynbrook, Long Island, is teaching God's timeless truths in the 21st century.
Our church is far more than a Sunday worship service.
It's a place of learning where the scriptures are studied and the preaching of the gospel is clear and relevant.
It's like a gym where one can exercise their faith through community involvement.
It's like a hospital for wounded souls where one can find compassionate people and healing.
We're a diverse family of all ages,
enthusiastically serving our Lord Jesus Christ
in fellowship, play, and together.
Hi, I'm Pastor Bob Waldeman, and I invite you to come and join us here at Lynbrook Baptist Church and see all that a church can be.
Call Lynbrook Baptist at 516-599-9402. That's 516-599-9402, or visit lynbrookbaptist.org. That's lynbrookbaptist.org.
Chef Exclusive Catering is in South Central Pennsylvania. Chef Exclusive's goal is to provide a dining experience that is sure to please any palate. Chef Damian White of Chef Exclusive is a graduate of the renowned Johnson & Wales University with a degree in culinary arts and applied science. Chef Exclusive Catering's event center is newly designed with elegance and style and is available for small office gatherings, bridal showers, engagement parties, and rehearsal dinners. Critics and guests alike acknowledge Chef Exclusive's commitment to exceeding even the highest expectations. I know of their quality firsthand since Chef Exclusive catered my most recent Iron Sharpens Iron Radio Pastor's Luncheon. For details, call 717-388-3000. That's 717-388-3000. Or visit chefexclusive.com. That's chefexclusive.com.
Hi,
Hi, I'm Pastor Bill Shishko, inviting you to tune in to A Visit to the Pastor's Study every Saturday from 12 noon to 1 p.m. Eastern Time on WLIE Radio, www.wlie540am.com. We bring biblically faithful pastoral ministry to you, and we invite you to visit the pastor's study by calling in with your questions. Our time will be lively, useful, and I assure you, never dull. Join us this Saturday at 12 noon Eastern Time for a visit to the pastor's study, because everyone needs a pastor.
Hi, I'm Buzz Taylor, frequent co-host with Chris Arnson on Iron Sharpens Iron Radio. I would like to introduce you to my good friends Todd and Patty Jennings at CVBBS, which stands for Cumberland Valley Bible Book Service. Todd and Patty specialize in supplying Reformed and Puritan books and Bibles at discount prices that make them affordable to everyone. Since 1987, the family-owned and operated book service has sought to bring you the best available Christian books and Bibles at the best possible prices. Unlike other book sites, they make no effort to provide every book that is available because, frankly, much of what is being printed is not worth your time. That means you can get to the good stuff faster. It also means that you don't have to worry about being assaulted by the pornographic, heretical, and otherwise faith-insulting material promoted by the secular book vendors. Their website is cvbbs.com. Browse the pages at ease, shop at your leisure, and purchase with confidence as Todd and Patty work in service to you, the church, and to Christ. That's Cumberland Valley Bible Book Service at cvbbs.com. That's cvbbs.com. Let Todd and Patty know that you heard about them on Iron Sharpens Iron Radio.
Charles Haddon Spurgeon once said,
"Give yourself unto reading. The man who never reads will never be read. He who never quotes will never be quoted. He who will not use the thoughts of other men's brains proves that he has no brains of his own. You need to read."
Solid Ground Christian Books is a publisher and book distributor who takes these words of the Prince of Preachers to heart. The mission of Solid Ground Christian Books is to bring back treasures of the past to minister to Christians in the present and future, and to publish new titles that address burning issues in the church and the world. Since its beginning in 2001, Solid Ground has been committed to publish God-centered, Christ-exalting books for all ages. We invite you to go treasure hunting at solid-ground-books.com. That's solid-ground-books.com and see what priceless literary gems from the past or present you can unearth from Solid Ground. Solid Ground Christian Books is honored to be a weekly sponsor of Iron Sharpens Iron Radio.
Iron Sharpens Iron Radio is sponsored by Harvey Cedars, a year-round Bible conference and retreat center nestled on the Jersey Shore. Harvey Cedars offers a wide range of accommodations to suit groups up to 400. For generations, Christians have enjoyed gathering and growing at Harvey Cedars. Each year, thousands of high school and college students come and learn more about God's Word. An additional 9,000 come annually to Harvey Cedars as families, couples, singles, men, women, pastors, seniors, and missionaries. 90 miles from New York City, 70 miles from Philly, and 95 miles from Wilmington, and easily accessible, scores of notable Christian groups frequently plan conferences at Harvey Cedars, like the Navigators, InterVarsity Christian Fellowship, Campus Crusade, and the Alliance of Confessing Evangelicals. Find Harvey Cedars on Facebook or at hcbible.org, hcbible.org. Call 609-494-5689, 609-494-5689. Harvey Cedars, where Christ finds people and changes lives. Welcome back. This is Chris Arnson, and if you just tuned us in, our guest today for the full 2 hours with just about 25 minutes to go is retired U.S. Army Colonel David M. Glantz. He is the chief editor of the Journal of Slavic Military Studies, and we are addressing Russia and what threat it poses, if any, to the United States in the 21st century. And our email address, if you'd like to join us, It's chrisarnson@gmail.com. chrisarnson@gmail.com if you have a question for Colonel Glantz. And if you intend to send in a question, please do it quickly because we're running out of time. One of our listeners is Lieutenant Colonel Kevin Gerard from Dawsonville, Georgia, who has been a guest, actually, on Iron Sharpens Iron Radio. And he had spent some time here in the Carlisle area when doing some work with the War College before returning to Georgia. And it's so nice to hear from him today. And Lieutenant Colonel Kevin Gerard says, "Greetings, brother. Please pass on my warm regards to Colonel Glantz this afternoon. How has Russia suffered from Islamic terrorism in the 21st century?" That's one of two questions he has.
Well, from the Islamic standpoint, they would claim, they would assert that it's Russian imperialism that has caused the problem. But from the Russian point of view, basically the entire Caucasus region, North and South Caucasus, the entire corridor up the Volga River to Kazan, all of Central Asia are essentially Islamic countries. There have been terrorist attacks. These began back fairly early in the late 1980s, early 1990s, bombings in Moscow, bombings in Leningrad, then St. Petersburg, lots of bombings in the North Caucasus region, a school bombing in Breslan was, I guess, the most infamous of these. So they've had quite a bit of terror. Now, they've also had terrorism or at least insurgency that the Russians would cause to call terrorism in Chechnya, and that prompted the First and Second Chechen Wars. They've got a similar problem in Dagestan. Today, that's the area east of Chechnya between the Caucasus and the Chechen borders. And they've had smaller outbreaks in others of those states. But what they're worried about primarily is the spread of the militant version of the religion. I don't want to cover the entire religion with a blanket, but the militant portion northward into the sections, because essentially if it goes northward east to the west of the Urals, it could split the Russian Federation in half. It would also preclude the, if it spreads to the Central Asian republics, it would preclude any Russian restoration of contacts or partnership with those nations. And I think one of the sleepers in this whole equation is Kazakhstan, whose President Nazarbayev is becoming rather aged. To me, the question is going to be, when Nazarbayev departs, will the Russians, since they have the Cosmodrome in Kazakhstan, the old nuclear testing area, and they have a sizable Russian population there, will they attempt to form some sort of confederation with Kazakhstan, bring it back into the orb? This would obviously solve problems with China, which is also interested in those areas of Central Asia. So that's a thumbnail sketch of the relationships. This is historical in nature because few people remember that back in the 19th century, the Russian Empire was the defender of Christianity in the Middle East, and they were responsible for defending the temples there and the churches and cathedrals. That has something to do with why they are doing what they're doing in Syria today.
And Lieutenant Colonel Kevin Gerard's second question is, why do U.S. policymakers seem so hostile to the idea of cooperating with Russia against ISIS?
I've got ideas, but I'm not going to tell you what they are. for fear of blowback. This is a problem that dates back to the original partnership agreement, one of whose bases was fighting Islamic terrorism. And one of the last things I did as director of the Foreign Military Studies Office was approve arrangements being made. Annual summer meetings were being held between all the intelligence agencies and had been for several years in Chicago. And those meetings were going to continue, and they were focused on what had happened in New York, what had happened in other areas, the explosions in Beirut, and all that entire effort was stopped abruptly in 1994. I won't tell you why, because I don't know why, but it didn't surface again until 2001. And that day I was traveling to North Texas to spend several days giving talks, and the first plane hit the tower. My wife's an inveterate radio listener, and she said, "What's that mean?" I said, "That's awful. That's terrible." And the second one hit. I said, "That's war." A few minutes later, they said they were closing the airspace, and I said, my God, they're going to close the ports next, because a target list that I had signed off on or helped approve the summer of 93 had that list. Now, somebody must have kept it in their desk at the Pentagon, but that stuff ended abruptly in 1994. It was swept under the table and didn't surface again in 2001. The same thing has happened since 2008, and you can speculate as to why that might be.
Thank you so much, Lieutenant Kevin, Lieutenant Colonel Kevin Girard, and I hope to have you back on Iron Sharpens Iron Radio in the near future. We have Daniel in San Jose, California, who asked, does the state in which our nation is currently in show some similarities to the era, culture, etc., that led to World War II?
Ooh. There are problems in this country right now that problems of social discord, political discord, unwillingness to compromise that bring back many of America. I read an old essay when I was before I taught at West Point. We gave it out to, this was back in the 60s, we gave it out to students there. It was Crane Brinton's The Anatomy of Revolution. There were the continuities or something about revolutions and how they're characterized. And if you read that pamphlet today, that article today, you'll say, God, we're in the same state that they were in various revolutions in the past. We are in an unstable state, and that is quite bothersome.
We have Gordy in Mechanicsburg, Pennsylvania. He has two questions. In your opinion, should the nations of the world be more concerned about Vladimir Putin or Kim Jong-un?
Perhaps you shouldn't separate the problems, but to answer your question, Putin is less of a concern if we adopt policies that are sane rather than policies that are insane. Kim has been a proxy for many years. He's been a proxy of China. He's been a proxy of Russia, Soviet Union, or at least his father was. There are strings attached to his back. I can't define what those strings are. But he is a more immediate concern, but if you address that concern, you have to address another one as well, and that's China.
And Gordy's second question is there any significance to the fact that Kim Jong-un's grandfather served in the Soviet 88th Battalion?
The Soviet 88th Battalion was a battalion formed in the Soviet Army that went into Manchuria in August 45. They took part in the liberation of North Korea. I think they were with the 10th Mechanized Corps when it came down in there, and that was the nucleus of the military of the future North Korean state. Yes, it is symbolic. That is a direct tie between the Soviet Union, and the question is, have those ties with Korea languished since the fall of the Soviet Union? I think many of them have. However, you've got to ask yourself whether the ties between the PLA and actions in 1951 have faded away as well. And that question is still to be answered.
We have CJ in Lindenhurst, Long Island, New York, who wants to, who asks, can you please define what the O-Zero Cooperative is? And if you can give us any information on Putin's links to Petromed and Putin's palace. We still haven't heard what Putin's palace was or is.
I have no idea what you're talking about, frankly. Okay. And I'm sorry I don't.
Well, I guess you'll have to ask Karen DeWisha about that. Thank you very much for your question today. Well, one of the things that I want to, before we run out of time, I want you to give right now a summary of your impressions about the paranoia that that many citizens of the United States have about Russia. That, of course, has taken many forms going back to the days of McCarthy and even earlier, Joseph McCarthy. But and you have people both on the right and the left side of the aisle politically who claim to have some kind of disdain or fear or apprehension about the Russian Federation, about Putin. Perhaps some of those reasons are not completely genuinely rising out of concerns for the United States, but personal political gain. But what is your overall opinion on that?
In my opinion, the present paranoia is unjustified. I think it is politically motivated and politically generated. I think one would be wiser to consider the other side of the equation, Russian paranoia, because that is there and has been there, and it's there for good reason. It was certainly present as a result of World War II, the absolutely savaging of the country. It was certainly there with the fall of the Soviet Union, and people felt that personally, and the fall of the Russian Federation. When you lose your nation, paranoia tends to set in. It was there with the expansion of NATO. It was there on other equations, like the U.S.'s refusal to seriously cooperate with the anti-Islamic program. But this paranoia that's risen in this country since the election is, I think, the most dangerous paranoia of all, because it is not based on a rational foundation. I think it's damaging, and I think the more it lasts, the more damaging it will be. And I think if there is problem with Russia, it may be the cause of the problem rather than Russian actions themselves.
And how many times have you actually visited in your life and career the Kremlin and the Soviet Union? And have you been back to Russia since the falling of the Soviet Union?
I visited extensively in the 1970s when studying Russian. I went there as a major in the U.S. Army. They knew who I was. They knew I was studying Russian, and we played many, many games with our KGB counterparts who tailed us. I was there in the 1980s. In 1987, I was the first officer to be allowed by our country to visit since the outbreak of the Afghan War, the invasion of Afghanistan in 1979. That's when I made this declaration to the Academy of Sciences about telling your own history. I was there three-quarters of the year, each year, from 1988 to 1993. I've been back once, 1997, to a conference. My wife won't let me go because I got poisoned in 1992, possibly poisoned in 1992, and she cares for me.
That's right. Can you tell us a little bit more about that?
No, well, not really, because Army medicine precluded finding out what it was that laid me up for 6 months and almost killed me, because they did the test too late, and there had been a bacteria, but it had disappeared. They couldn't identify what it was, but I do know that later on, someone from the Army medical office in Texas said, yeah, you're one of those in 92 that got poisoned. Wouldn't surprise me, but I don't hold it against them. There were a lot of folks that didn't want cooperation on that side, too.
You don't hold it against them for poisoning you? Now, obviously, you don't know yet if it was intentional poisoning.
No, right? I have no idea. Idea whatsoever.
Now,
if you've eaten Russian salads, you run a substantial risk.
Okay.
You did anyway at that point.
By the way, one of my favorite restaurants in Manhattan is Firebird, which is a Russian restaurant. It is absolutely incredible, and I've got to go back. My late wife and I used to love going to Firebird and having their borscht.
Borscht. Yeah. Borscht. Good borscht is great.
And this had duck meat in it and all kinds of stuff. But
you didn't get that in Russia.
Right, I didn't assume.
Maybe this, dog.
This was
dog.
Like, this was supposed to be a picture of the czarist Russia. It was like a like you were walking into a millionaire's home. It was a very fancy place. It wasn't like a more of a rustic kind of a Russian place. But did you make friendships close acquaintances, anyway, with people that you spoke with and visited while you were making these many trips? And did you and do you have to keep yourself on guard from having your views of their politics and their history in any way colored or softened because of the fact that you may have made friendships?
No, I certainly made friendships, and that was part of the mission of building the bridges, was to meet people and make friends out of people. We entertained many Russian generals, many Russian junior officers. I found most of them to be very courteous and would come upstairs in the evening and talk in my office, and we'd talk about things that indicated we were very much alike. There was only one person in the entire entourage of about 50 we entertained that my wife said she should have poisoned. She was probably right, because he was a rather nasty character, and he ended up as Zhirinovsky's Goebbels.
Wow. That's quite a comparison.
Very apt comparison.
Really? I mean, he was actually...
He was Zhirinovsky's information officer, mm-hmm. Yes.
And I'm assuming brutal with that kind of a comparison.
He was also in Vietnam when I was there, but he was flying Russian helicopters further north from where I was.
Mm-hmm.
And he was KGB.
Now, why? What would be a reason that somebody from... Now this poisoning attempt, that was under the Russian Federation, or
This was 1992, September 9th, because I keep record of my running each day. I had run 6 miles out by the Academy of the General Staff, came back, had a bad case of diarrhea, took an Imodium pill, and by the next day, every muscle in my body ached. When I got back to the States, I tried to run my 6 miles. I made a quarter of a mile and quit. And it was a six-month battle thereafter.
Yeah, and I remember you saying over lunch that there were also a number of other people.
Yes, yes. There were quite a few, a lot of Canadians also, who suffered the same problem. We learned in the 70s in Moscow and Leningrad that if you wanted to drink water safely, you had to pour scotch in it. It will then turn purple potassium permanganate from the dead whatever it was in there, and it was safe to drink.
And we, right at this very moment, are hearing the sounds of thousands of Presbyterians calling their travel agents to go to Russia. But
oh, boy. He said that on my behalf.
What would be any reason why somebody from the Russian Federation would want to poison you?
Well, in 1992, 89, 90, 91, 92, there was a great debate going on. Obviously, do you develop a partnership with your adversary during the entire Cold War? I mean, there were a few people then saying we brought the Soviet Union down. That didn't go over very well. Incidentally, we didn't.
Mm-hmm.
And the people now saying routinely we won the Cold War and brought the Soviet Union down does raise their hackles, because by extension, obviously, you want to bring the Russian Federation down. Talk about paranoia. There's the root of the paranoia.
So you don't agree with the accolades that Ronald Reagan received for bringing down the...
He didn't bring it down. I mean, he and Gorbachev had a handshake. The handshake was a mutual agreement between the two to cease this senseless Cold War. That's exactly what was done. It was ceased. And Gorbachev was laying the groundwork for the partnership before Yeltsin, before the Soviet Union fell in 91.
Now, when you were making these trips to...
One thing.
Sure.
If you want some evidence of this, go back into my Journal of Slavic Military Study, which I changed the title. It was originally the Journal of Soviet Military Studies.
Okay.
Because of the partnership program, I changed the term to Slavic for lack of a better word. If you look at the 1996 issues, you'll find an article in there between a Captain Baranov and myself, a naval captain in the Russian Navy, that talks about the bases for that partnership. It's right there in black and white. So as late as 96, where we're still talking about it.
And during those trips, those many trips that you made to the Kremlin and to the Soviet Union and to Russia, did you ever get on that plane thinking, I may never go home?
Yes.
Every time? Or?
If you've flown on an Ilyushin out of Leningrad Airport in 1976, you realize that all of the Russian pilots are fighter pilots, and the way they test the ice in the runway is to go down the runway full speed and stand the brakes on. If it's fine, they turn around and go the other way and go full speed again. Yes, I've ridden on several Russian aircraft that I think I'd rather not have.
But other than that, I mean, more sinister reasons.
No sinister reasons whatsoever.
And as far as... when you were involved in these military meetings in the Kremlin and so on behalf, representing the United States government, and going up through the current day, what are the benefits of cooperation that you see with the United States and then the Soviet Union and now Russian Federation?
Mutual security, clear and simple. And this is another penchant we have. When we talk about negotiations, we scarcely give account to what their national security requires. I remember a senator, several have done this on television, saying, "Why, goodness, Russia doesn't work in the security interest of the United States." Of course not. Nations don't work in the security interest of other nations. What they do is cooperate so the security of interests of both are addressed.
And how do you respond to people who think that since Putin and the Russian Federation should not be trusted, that any kind of in-depth cooperation and exchanging of critical information with them, it only really puts us in jeopardy of having of getting stabbed in the back and having something occur to us that never would have likely happened otherwise?
Well, it's nonsense, because before you have sharing of critical information, whatever that is, you should have a discussion of issues and topics of interest to both, extensive discussions. One of the unfortunate instances of the last 8 years is that those discussions were precluded, and no one in the U.S. military, to my knowledge, was allowed to speak to his counterpart. That does not help a mutual understanding in any way, shape, or form.
Now, we see images today of Putin in Russian Orthodox churches lighting candles and things like that. Do you think that this is just a masquerade? I mean, he after all, was a part of a regime, a very crucial element of a regime that was trying to stamp out religion from existence.
Yeah, but that's you don't understand what was happening in the early 1980s in Russia. You remember Reagan's comment when they said, "Why don't you negotiate?" He said, "I can't find a Russian who lives long enough to negotiate with." After the death of Brezhnev and the death of Chernenko, you had Andropov who was in it. You had several attempts by former KGB people to fix this mess before it all fell in. Putin was assigned to his post in East Germany as a part of that effort to reform the KGB. He was supposed to be there to watch Honecker, who was the most radical of all the communists in Eastern Europe, and they were afraid the guy was going to do something that would really screw up East-West relations. That's Putin's background. So it's a mixed background. Obviously, he's KGB, but he's also FSB, and he also was sent there to do a mission of reform to some extent. Now, I don't know what his personal proclivities are, but I think one of his major concerns is restoring national pride to Russia in an imperial sort of way, in a Russian unified nation. He has not clamped down on the press. I have friends I know in Russia who write things about Putin that are worse than the things written about Trump in this country. And he hasn't been killed yet. I keep warning him, but he keeps doing it.
And, well, I'd like you to basically give us a summary of your final thoughts on this issue. And there were many issues, actually, we were discussing. But your final thoughts that you want our listeners to have etched in their hearts and minds in regard to Russia.
Final thoughts are read a little history. Don't need to read a lot of it, but read a little history. And read the old history. Don't read the new rewritten history that's been written with a purpose to erase the past. Understand the Russians. Be prepared to discuss with the Russians openly. Be prepared for negotiations over things that are worth negotiating, because if you don't negotiate, I can tell you that both the interests of the Russian Federation and the United States are going to suffer down the road, because we haven't seen, new forces are on the scene that we're going to have to deal with down the road.
David Innes, do you have any final question for David Glantz?
Yeah, well, if we have time, I've had this on my mind. Politics, you mentioned Stalin. Politics is very seductive, and it can become cultic, and certainly there was a cult of personality around Stalin, as Khrushchev described it. What can we learn from the Russian experience, especially in Russia, where it's a very religious country, as you described, and yet it fell into this cult of personality? And we're tempted by that in this country, whether you're talking about fanatical devotees of Donald Trump or Barack Obama. It's across the spectrum.
Yeah,
any thoughts on that sort of temptation?
I have very strong thoughts about that. Cults of personality are dangerous. Yeah, this goes back to the power corrupts absolute, power corrupts absolutely. We saw it under Stalin reach its worst. We saw it under Hitler the same way. We see it in Kim in North Korea. Brezhnev, in fact, tried to reach that pinnacle, fell ill before he could do so. There is a danger with Putin. Now, the disinclination to do that is what happened to the predecessors that did that. They were unsuccessful and unsuccessful to a major degree. Some are simply shot. But Putin is susceptible, and I would say any leader who purports to speak for the nation is susceptible to the same thing. And the only check on that is the population of the nation being educated properly. That is the major check on personality cults.
Well, I want to thank you so much, Colonel David Glantz, for being our guest today. I look forward to having you back on the program. I know that your website is glantzbooks.com, glantzbooks.com. I want to thank you as well, Dr. David Innes, for joining us as a co-host today. And the website for the King's College is tkc.edu, tkc.edu. And you can look up more about Dr. David Innes by typing in INNES in the search engine. That's INN as in Nancy, ES. And I want to thank the Reverend Buzz Taylor in the studio for being my co-host today as well. I want to thank everybody who took the time to not only listen but write in questions. And I want you all to always remember for the rest of your lives that Jesus Christ is a far greater Savior than you are a sinner.